This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Here are Checkers. No, Checkers probably Steph Curry, right? He's got the finesse. He's got the moves.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Kevin Durant of Education Reform, Robert Pendicio.
Does that mean I'm moving to Oakland? I'm taking my talents to Oakland?
Well, you know, Oakland. I mean, Sacramento.
Golden State?
They're in Sacramento.
That's right? The Sacramento Kings.
Oh, no. Really?
Yeah, they play in Oakland.
Oh, my God. I
hope I'm
wrong.
Right about that. I'm not a huge NBA fan, but a pocket full of knowledge for their iPhone. I'm reasonably sure it's Oakland.
Okay, well, now I'm just embarrassed. But let's get back to the analogy here, Kevin. It's more, Robert, that a couple of years ago, you know, we already had this incredibly strong team at Fordham, right?
And then
we still
slumming by signing me.
And we still sought out an all-star to make our team even better.
To lose championships to Cleveland.
All right. Okay. Robert's right. It's Oakland.
All right. See that?
Darn it. That all makes sense now. I was thinking, I thought it was Sacramento. How did I get that wrong?
If I'm Kevin Durant, that makes you Steph Curry?
Yes, that's right. Or Checker. Checker's, no, Checker's probably Steph Curry, right? He's got the finesse. He's got the moves.
So you're Clay.
He always goes from the outside.
Yeah, I've always thought you had feet of clay.
Uh-huh. All right. Yeah. All right. Well,
here we go.
Clearly, we have quickly exceeded my sports knowledge for that analogy. We'll have to look for something more pop culturally next week. Okay. It's the middle of the summer. It is
hot out.
Hot here in Washington, D.C., but still cool stuff to talk about. In education reform, Clara, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Mike, you recently wrote about rates of college readiness versus completion by different racial groups. What were the trends you found most encouraging, most concerning?
Well, you know, this is fascinating stuff to me. I've been doing this now for a couple of years, looking at a couple things. First of all, for kids as a whole, you can look at the percentage of students who are college prepared, according to the NAEP. This is basically proficient, the same level as proficient in reading. Mm-hmm. For math, they set this level somewhere between basic and proficient. Okay, this is where they say, if you hit this score, we think you're going to be do okay in college, take credit-bearing courses, pass them.
Yeah.
You can then look at the percentage of kids matriculating to college right away, and then you can look at the percentage of kids actually completing college, at least a four-year degree. Bottom line is, you know, we've never gotten more than 40% of kids above more than 40% of kids to the college prepared level.
Absolutely.
Okay. The most recent NAEP data I added those, same story.
And ACT defines it as, I think, 25%.
Yeah. I mean, I think ACT, SAT, you know, and keep in mind, these are kids who have graduated high school. So if you include dropouts, it's even lower.
True.
More like a third. So basically, we get about a third of our kids to college ready.
If we're lucky,
but 70% of kids today matriculate directly from high school to college.
At some level.
Right.
Not necessarily 4 years.
Right. They show up, they graduate in June, they show up in August to some institution of higher education.
Right.
And if you go out a couple more years, it's even higher than that. I mean, at this point, basically, higher education is universal for high school graduates. I mean, almost everybody gives it a shot.
It's getting there. Yeah.
They give it a shot. But our completion rates are still at about a third.
Right. So this concerns you, brother.
This concerns me. But then I had this idea, what if you looked these trends by race, and it was interesting. There are some differences. The white data look pretty much the same as the population as a whole, not too surprising. And then for Latino kids, there is more of a gap between college readiness and college completion, meaning that there are some Latino, or maybe I should say, I think it's Hispanic. There are some Hispanic kids who are ready for college who are not completing college. So that tells me that some of the efforts around higher education reform and you know, trying to work on access issues would still matter.
Or there's a difference between academic preparedness and cultural preparedness.
That could be That could be too. And there's been a big spike in just a few recent years in Hispanic college going. So we'll see how that plays out. But here's what's different. We're really interesting for African Americans and Asian Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Asian Americans, right? 50% college ready, so much higher than the other groups.
Yep.
Okay. But 2/3 of Asian Americans are completing 4-year college degrees.
Yeah, they are truly prepared.
2/3. And they are, think about that. That's much higher than the percentage that NAEP says are prepared. That means there's a bunch of Asian American kids who are not scoring at that college prepared level on the NAEP that are still completing.
Is it
college.
Our old friend non-cognitive skills, Michael?
Could be non-cognitive skills, could be support, could be all kinds of things, but they are outperforming where you'd expect them to do based on this test, at least in this case, a test of reading. The same goes for African American students, that something like 15% test college ready, but 22% actually complete. college degrees.
Not as large, so again, they outperform
what you'd expect on testing. And I raised this with my friend Marty West. He said, look, Mike, this is well known. The data show that kids of similar cognitive ability, that African-Americans tend to have more education, and that the hypothesis most people would say is that African-Americans know that there's discrimination in the labor market. And so getting a college education is even more important if you're African-American.
I also think that colleges have done a lot of work in the last 5 or 10 years to keep traditionally underserved kids attached and persisting. Mm-hmm. And that's a very good thing.
Absolutely. So, you know, I take all of this, Clara, to say a couple of things. First of all, if we really want to boost these college completion numbers, you know, we have got to get more kids college ready in the first place. That's Absolutely. Why we do what we do. The second thing, though, is I would say to some of the higher education folks, I think there's a lot of potential around Hispanic kids right now, that you do have this group of Hispanic kids who are performing well, at least on these tests, but are not completing college. And so, you know, finding out who those kids are and doing what we have to do to help them get all the way to and through those 4-year degrees could make a big difference.
I don't disagree.
Topic number two.
Robert, you're back at it with a new piece on language and cultural literacy. Can you explain what the Supreme Court's ruling in the Fisher versus University of Texas had to do with Beyonce?
The short answer is not a damn thing. The longer answer is I was just struck, as many of us were, by that very clever hashtag Becky with the bad grades.
I had not seen this, and you're a Twitter guy, and you're gonna have to explain it to me.
Okay, but you're much more of a Twitter guy than I am, so it strains my credulity that you didn't see this whatsoever. So in the hours after the University of Texas versus Abigail Fisher case, a lot of young people of color took to Twitter and dubbed her hashtag Becky with the bad grades. Mike, I'm embarrassed you don't know this. It's a reference to a Beyonce song where she is calling out a faithless lover and says, better call Becky with the good hair. And this took on many, many levels of complexity. Some of it may be profane. You can look it up on Urban Dictionary, Mike. Okay. I'm not going to do your homework for you. But it just struck me.
Becky is slang for a white girl?
It's kind of a blanket term for
Abigail Fisher is Becky with
became
the bad
dubbed
grades.
Becky with the bad grades. So it's kind of clever, and it's also a little bit of a face push, let's be honest. But what struck me was frankly nothing to do with the Fisher case. As you know, I'm a big cultural literacy guy. I'm a devotee of E.D. Hirsch's work. This was one of the few occasions where young people, and particularly young people of color, had a cultural reference that left guys like you and me scratching our heads. Mm-hmm. So if you think about this, and I don't want to make too much of it, we were for a moment not allowed into this conversation, so to speak. We couldn't interact on an equal playing field of knowledge because one group had a bit of knowledge that the other group did not have. And typically, it's exactly the other way around in our education system. We've made much of this over the years. Our language is filled with idioms and cultural references and allusions that the culture of power, as Lisa Delpit once said, has, and low-income kids of color might not have. For example, if I say Achilles' heel, if I say Pandora's box, I don't explain what those terms mean, and I'm guessing our listeners know exactly what they mean. You use them as kind of a cultural shorthand, and our language is peppered with these sort of allusions. Yep. Long story short is that I'm making yet another case for cultural literacy here, but the twist this time is, you know what? It evolves. For anybody who's concerned that when they hear the phrase cultural literacy, oh, that's that dead white guy stuff. Yeah, for the most part it is right now, but it's not going to stay that way.
But this is interesting, Robert. I mean, that means if you had to go back and dust off Don Hirsch's list that was appended to cultural literacy has it been updated? Has he updated
That's
it?
A great question.
And if you updated it, how many of those items from 1987 would stay and how many would go? And by the way, how many started in pop culture?
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, even many of the old ones were probably from... You know. Frankly,
yeah, of course.
You know, I don't give a damn. The Casablanca line. See, I can't even do it.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
So, right. A lot of these probably came from pop culture. Right?
And you can, it's very easy to dismiss those. Oh, that's just pop culture references. That's just slang. But slang plus wide usage over time becomes tomorrow's idiomatic language. And the point I made in the piece that I wrote for U.S. News and for Gadfly is that we don't control this process. It's completely organic. And in a very diverse nation like ours, we should expect more and more of this. It'll almost accelerate. One example I used in the piece was our grandparents might have used the expression 23 skidoo, and our children are more likely to say things like bounce or peace out. Now, you can, again, say that those are slang, But as I'm very fond of pointing out, a dictionary is not a rule book. It's a history book. So it doesn't tell us how to use language. It tells us how language has been used.
Peace out, Robert.
Peace out, Michael.
Okay, topic number three, Claire.
The Louisiana Education Department is enlisting the help of educators to create a homegrown Common Core-aligned program. What's driving the state's unusual decision to do so?
Well, first, let's say why this is so unusual, Robert. I mean, you hear states all the time. They say we are a local control state. We will get in trouble politically if we try to put a curriculum out there. And you hear this is deep red Louisiana somehow does it. And though there's been issues down in Louisiana, I don't hear anybody explicitly complaining about this curriculum that they've been working on.
No, and look at the experience of Engage New York, where they built that curriculum, not unlike what Louisiana did for New York educators, and what happened. It's been downloaded promiscuously across the country, including more outside of New York than inside.
Though, let's point out, there has been political controversy about it within New York, right? That the teachers within New York feel like it's a mandate. They feel like, and maybe that's true, that some of their administrators have told them you have to teach this stuff, and so then they don't like it.
Well, there are two things. I could truly argue this one round or flat. There's one really good thing about this and one not so good thing. The good thing is that it illustrates yet again the demand for high quality materials. And that, teachers are probably a little bit closer to the ground and better positioned to know what their students need. Great. The bad news, I would argue, and I think there was a line about this in the Education Week piece about the Louisiana initiative, there's still a tendency to borrow incoherent stuff. It could be good stuff, but curriculum works best when it's coherent. In other words, when there's an overarching sense of beginning, middle, and end, I'm going to learn this and this grade, this and the other grade. If teachers are just borrowing one-offs, as it were, a good lesson today, a different lesson tomorrow, I'm not sure that's any better than what they started with.
It's tricky right now, though, right, Robert? I mean, we are living in an era, a populist era, an anti-elitist era, an anti-centralization era, right? And so when local communities feel like somebody else, whether in the state capital or in Washington, D.C., much less Brussels, is telling them what to do, they are going to chafe at that. So the trick here, it seems like, is to do whatever it takes to make it quite clear that this is all about support and help. It's voluntary. Nobody has to do this in Louisiana. It is up to the local communities. Look, and I think that's how John White has done this so far. There's been a ton of great work done letting teachers in on the Common Core, giving them great professional learning experiences, letting them teach each other and go deeper. And it's been kind of quiet below the radar screen. That's probably where it needs to stay.
I don't disagree with you, but again, and I'm going to strain for an analogy here, we still have an unsophisticated view of curriculum in education at large. So in a way, I used to hear this in New York all the time with Engage New York. We would encourage teachers to, quote, adapt or adopt it. And I'd always be the guy who'd say, adopt. Don't dabble in this. In other words, if you build a coherent curriculum, you wouldn't say, borrow a few parts from this brand new BMW Ford
but
Duster.
Robert, you sound like an elitist.
Oh, nice.
I mean, how do you keep it from sounding like, damn it, just take the curriculum and teach it, and we know
what
best, and
before.
Stop questioning and just do it, because idiots can't, if you dabble, you'll mess it up.
Well, you know,
I mean, it sounds like Steve Jobs. He wants his closed system on his iPhone because his people are he can design it better than anyone.
I have failed to persuade you for years. I'm not going to succeed today. No, but look, all I will say is there are procedures in every profession. If your surgeon puts a mask on your head and says, hey, you know what I like to be about being a brain surgeon? I get to be creative and make it up as I go along. Get off the table. Run away.
Just talking politics, baby. Just talking politics.
All right.
That is all the time we've got for this week. Peace out. Peace out. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Do the folks in Richmond celebrate the 4th of July?
Heck yeah, we had some great fireworks Saturday night.
I'm glad to hear. Well, you know, there was that whole Civil War thing that happened between now and then.
Yeah,
and, just want to make sure.
It was phenomenal. It was my first fireworks in Richmond, and there were supposed to be 4,000 people show up. There were 11,000 people
that's
there.
That's great.
It was crazy.
And was the weather okay?
Oh. Beautiful weather. They did it Saturday, not Monday.
Smart.
That was smart.
New York City Macy's fireworks last night. There were 11,000 people in my building.
Well, nice. Well,
yeah, yes. Come to Richmond.
We can't all be New Yorkers.
Right? Yes, that's right.
All right, what you got for us,
we
Amber?
We got a new experimental study out by AAIR in Michigan State that examines whether interim assessments have an effect on improving outcomes for students at the lower, middle, and higher ends of the distribution. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a neat study, and mm-hmm. you don't see stuff like this very often. Mm-hmm. But they a special focus on the lower end, of course. Specifically, they studied two assessment programs in Indiana, MCLASS, which is used in grades K through 2. This reminds me of Dibbles because the way to describe it, it's like a face-to-face diagnostic where teachers enter results in their handheld device, yeah. okay, like on the yeah. spot. And then Acuity, A-C-U-I-T-Y, mm-hmm. am I saying that right?
I think you are.
It's a McGraw-Hill product, mm-hmm. okay? And they use that in grades 3 through 8. That's administered paper pencil, okay? So K-8 schools volunteered to take part in the study. And they had to meet certain criteria, like they couldn't have used either one of those assessments previously. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then they're randomly assigned to treatment and control conditions, like, great, you got schools that volunteer and they participate and mm-hmm. agree to, you know, say all the conditions they needed. So they were 2009-10 academic year, they were assigned to treatment and control. All right. Start out with 116 schools that met the criteria. They had 4 different criteria. 70 were randomly selected to participate. Then you got down to 57, which were ultimately assigned, and then just 50 participated due to attrition. This is kind of important because they've got this intent to treat effect and then mm-hmm. the treatment on the treated effect. I won't get into all that wonky stuff, but that's why these numbers are mm-hmm. important if you read the study. Okay. All right. Anyway, they conduct various analyses, each of which target, again, impact at the lower, middle, and upper tails of the distribution. Mm-hmm. In general, the results show that in grades 3 through 8, lower achievers seem to benefit more from interim assessments mm-hmm. than higher achieving students. Mm-hmm. The magnitude of the effects were larger, here we go again, in math than in reading.
Mm-hmm. No surprise.
In some cases, the estimates for math were larger than 1/5 of a standard deviation, which wow. is pretty sizable. The treatment on treatment results in particular, again, that's the 50 schools who participated, mm-hmm. show that reading and math results were both insignificant at grades K through 2, which again use this MCLASS mm-hmm. instrument.
Okay.
And then there's a whole page, which I thought was a great discussion on why this may have happened at K2. Okay. So MCLASS is not as effective as Acuity. Okay. That's reasonable, right? The effects of tests like these aren't as visible in early grades. Mm-hmm. MCLASS impact was not adequately captured by Terra Nova, because remember, there's not a state sure. test mm-hmm. in the early grades, nor is Terra Nova aligned to Indiana standards, nor is MCLASS aligned to Terra Nova. Mm-hmm. And then ISTEP is used for accountability purposes, so teachers likely pay more attention to those interim test results. Make sense? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Like, what do we make of this? I mean, the bottom line is that in this study, interim assessments didn't seem to have much effect on improving outcomes for middling or high performing kids.
Mm-hmm. But it did have an effect at the low end.
It did.
That's encouraging.
It is.
Right? I mean, isn't that why we're all sitting around this table? Because we're trying to improve to bring the low end up to the middle?
Well
that's one goal. That's not our only goal.
Right.
Fair enough, Robert.
We want to see some kind of improvement for the other kids too, don't we?
Right. And in Indiana, there is a growth model. Their accountability mm-hmm. system does give some hints to schools that growth for all kids matters. Though I will say the design of that accountability system, which I happen to have looked at recently, mm-hmm. Is much more focused on the low performers. That, you know, 25% of the score is for growth or low performing kids. So there okay. still is this nudge that those kids are the ones you're supposed to pay the most attention to. But who knows if that's it. I mean, so right. you then would need to see this in another state that maybe has a different accountability system. It may just be that, you know, we see that the neediest kids, the lowest performing kids, you know, tend to be in those schools where they use these interim assessments quite vigorously. Mm-hmm. And maybe that gives the teachers clear information about what to do with those kids. We see the backlash to these kinds of interim assessments among, in many cases, the more affluent, higher achieving
kids. Too much testing.
Right? And they are not wrong, it turns out. Out, right? Right. It isn't adding much value for their kids.
Yeah. No, it's not. Yeah.
Boy. How much time is it taking and what are the teachers doing with the data from the interim assessments?
You know, I think the one took, I want to say 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay.
And the other one, I've seen them. If it's like Dibbles, it's literally right. 5 minutes. So it's really short. So, I mean, that's why.
This is super important because there, of course, has been this huge debate about too much testing. And mm-hmm. many people have been saying, many of the reform advocates say, hey, don't blame the federal requirements or the state requirements. There's all this local testing that's happened. Mm-hmm. Partly that's because of teacher evaluation. Take that off the table. Districts say, hey, I like using these interim assessments. They're the ones that are giving us information. If we get rid of it, right, it's going to hurt achievement.
Right.
Well, this is what it says. Maybe it would hurt achievement for the lower performers, but not for the other kids.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, you were interested in doing a study like this.
I was, in fact, randomly assigned.
Let's get districts to like not take these formative tests and let's see, you know, what happens. So
I still want to do that study. Yeah. I mean, to do the opposite way. Right. Yeah. So basically say, okay, find a bunch of places that have been doing interim assessments and convince some of them to give them up.
Right.
And see if it has any negative impact on their achievement, or whether they, at this point, can manage without it. They can get decent enough information from the state tests.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I mean, but you see in a study like this, they literally, I mean, they had to create a study, right? It wasn't a natural experiment. They had to convince all these people in schools to take place. I mean, that's why these studies like this are rare, but really necessary and a great addition to what we don't know about interim assessments.
Let's do more of it.
Amen.
Okay. That is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week,
I'm Robert Pandisio.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.